Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today on WREN 97.9. Our show today, we're going to talk about the Affordable Care Act with Carolyn Engelhardt. She's an associate professor, UVA School of Medicine from the Department of Public Health Sciences. Carolyn, welcome back.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be back with you and your radio audience again.
Well, you know, we try and have you in every year or 18 months because obviously the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare, has so much about it that changes, whether it's what's going on in the world of insurance or what's happening and how it's the Affordable Care Act is being treated in Washington, D.C., that we need to have you here to tell us about it. So can we start with just a relatively brief 4-5 minute history on the Affordable Care Act? It's now 10 years old.
Yep, 10 years old in March.
So start with the history of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. It does seem like ancient history now. So your listeners will probably remember that in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected president, he ran on a campaign of expanding health coverage. We were going into a recession in 2008, and at that time there were almost 50 million Americans who did not have insurance, and there were lots of problems with our insurance sector. If you were someone who was older or sicker or had a chronic illness, and so President Obama campaigned on and then was elected and tried to once again, for the seventh time in our nation's history, enact a health care reform bill that would nationalize a part of our health care system for those people who fell through the cracks. So predominantly, people get health insurance through their jobs. 160 million Americans get health insurance at their jobs. And so he didn't want to turn the whole system upside down since many people were fairly happy with their health coverage. So the Affordable Care Act really focused on those populations that didn't get health insurance at their jobs or who were unable to buy it on the open market because they had a pre-existing health condition. And it was a very tortured legislative experience. It immediately became partisan, polarized, and was passed in a very difficult way, with lots of bumps and intrigue, and it's not going to work, and maybe it will, and maybe it won't, and I could spend a whole hour with you just talking about all the legislative shenanigans. But let's just say that it finally passed. It is the only piece of major social policy in this country that did not garner one vote from the opposing party. So there was not one Republican vote for the Affordable Care Act. And that should have given us a clue that it was going to be difficult to implement. And it was. But 10 years later, now, there are parts of the Affordable Care Act that many people just take for granted. They just take for granted that an insurance company can't not give you health insurance because you've had cancer or you have diabetes. People all of a sudden now, Medicaid forever was sort of the ugly stepchild of our healthcare system, was seen as a program for poor people and people who didn't work, and it had a stigma around it. Well, what the ACA did was provided an expanded Medicaid, and states had the option of picking it up, and now we have 37 states that do. And Medicaid now insures 1 in 5 Americans, and so the picture now is no longer, you know, you're that undeserving, lazy person over there getting health care free from the government. It's now, well, you know, my grandmother gets Medicaid in the nursing home, and my special needs child gets Medicaid. And so it's really mainstreamed that. It's still controversial because it's a government program. But the ACA, many pieces of the ACA now have become quite mainstream, and 20 million people have insurance now that did not have it before it was passed. So that brings us up to today. It's under threat again. It's been before the Supreme Court twice, and is coming up for its third attempt, and you'll probably want to ask me about that later.
Again, our guest today is Carolyn Engelhardt. She has spent years working at UVA School of Medicine in the Department of Public Health Sciences, which is why on our show today, Sunday morning wake-up call here on WREN 97.9, talking about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So, Carolyn, bringing us up to date from 10 years ago to today in the Affordable Care Act, but it's changed significantly in its lifetime, correct?
Well, it's been marginalized since President Trump was elected. I mean, it's been the bane of, the House of Representatives have, over the last decade, have tried to overturn the ACA over 70 times. It never made it through the Senate. There was that notorious night in the Senate chambers after Trump was first elected where John McCain came in and was the dissenting vote. So there was great fanfare to overturn the Affordable Care Act when Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And the Senate and the House of Representatives and the executive branch were all of the same party, the Republican Party. It was believed to be a fait accompli that the ACA would be overturned. And it's so interesting because that was 2017. So the ACA had been chugging along for several years, and many of the members of the House of Representatives who are reelected every 2 years, I mean, of course, they're incumbents, but new people do come in. Many of them had campaigned on overthrowing the Affordable Care Act, and that's all they knew about it. They really didn't know what the law was about. But it became the message that we are going to get rid of this horrible law and we're going to get something better. And what they realized, because most politicians, like most Americans, really don't understand how our healthcare system works. And it's incredibly complicated. It's a $3.7 trillion enterprise that touches everything that we do. It touches hospitals and physicians and patients and employment workers and insurance and government, it's everywhere. So when they tried to take it apart, what they found was that it's like the Jenga game. You know, you can't just start taking out pieces because pretty soon the whole thing will collapse. And what they knew is that their constituents really liked parts of the Affordable Care Act. They loved the part where young adults could stay on their parents' insurance till they were 26. They loved the part about ban on pre-existing conditions. They loved the part about no more annual limits on health care. So if you had a child who had a very expensive chronic disease, they couldn't have a cap on what could be spent. So they liked that, but there were just some things they didn't like the individual mandate and the tax penalty if you didn't have health insurance. And they mostly didn't like that it was viewed as a big government program and government just messes up everything. But when they tried to do the math to come up with a system that would keep the pieces people really liked, but get rid of the pieces they don't like, they didn't like, it just didn't work. It just didn't work. And so they never passed an alternative. And so then the Trump administration, mostly through executive orders, and to be fair to the Trump administration, President Obama had his share of executive orders like DACA. And so over the last decade or two decades, as our Congress has become increasingly more partisan, the legislative branch has become gridlocked and unable to pass a lot of legislation. And so the executive branch has tried to do things more through executive orders, which doesn't have the power of legislation, but can do some things. That's why you're seeing so many more cases coming to the Supreme Court that normally would have just been figured out in the legislative branch. So the Trump administration, when they couldn't overturn Obamacare, started to take it apart piece by piece. So they, under Obamacare, insurance companies could not offer what we call junk health plans. So bare bones health plans that didn't include things that were written in statute under the ACA that health insurance plans had to offer. Things like prescription drugs and inpatient care and outpatient care and rehabilitation services, things like that. But it made health insurance more expensive. So healthy young people who had to now pay more for insurance were unhappy. So the Trump administration said, okay, we're going to figure out a way so that those of you who don't want all those bells and whistles, you can buy bare bones junk health insurance plans and it won't cost you very much. So they had to work with certain governors, and some governors agreed to do it and some governors did not. And so you ended up just chipping away at the ACA, because the way insurance works, and this is, doesn't matter if it's car insurance or home insurance or health insurance, in order for insurance to work, you have to get a bunch of people, a lot of people in the insurance pool, most of whom will not use the insurance. So if you're in an insurance pool of only homeowners that live in floodplains, that will never work. Everybody will have claims. The premiums will become so expensive, nobody could afford it. Same is true of health insurance. You want to bring in people when they're young and healthy and don't use a lot of it. So when people get older and sicker, they do use it, but the healthy people balance it out. So if you give the healthy young people permission to leave the pool, then you, by definition, really change and jeopardize the whole insurance notion. That's why other countries that have national health insurance, they just make everybody be in it. Nobody gets a choice. They just take the money from their taxes and figure out how their healthcare system, what will cover and what they won't, and then they pay for it and everybody's in. That's not the way we do it. So it changed. So it made insurance more expensive. When that happened, and Charlottesville in 2017, going into the 2018 insurance year, had the highest increase in premiums in the whole country. Charlottesville, our own little Charlottesville. And there are lots of reasons for that, which we don't have to go into, but it was this destabilization of the insurance pool and all these things that President Trump and people at CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and at Department of Health and Human Services, which oversee Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. It was all of these different, many, many different things that reduced the availability of Obamacare plans, reduced outreach, reduced marketing, and so enrollments went down slightly as a result of that. So Obamacare is alive and well, but it has taken some hits for sure. And now with COVID and the economic crash and the loss of employment and the loss of employer-based health insurance, it is front and center again as to what we are going to do as a country about our healthcare system.
Rick Moore here, Sunday morning wake-up call. We're glad to be back for another week on the Wren. Our guest today, our expert on the Affordable Care Act, Carolyn Engelhardt, who is telling us all about how this works. And we're going to get into some information throughout the hour that you're going to want to keep tuned to hear all about it. Carolyn, 10 years old, almost everyone, depending on their side, has stayed strong. Why has each party stayed so strong? Democrats, they keep and carry it through. The GOP to repeal and replace.
Yeah, it's a really sad commentary on where we are right now, I think, in our history, politically speaking. Our founding fathers, we're a pretty young country, relatively speaking, and our founding fathers created our system of government with checks and balances and different branches of the government so that we would not have an oppressive monarchy, so we would not have a dictator. So there would be these ways of moving slowly. And in most everything we've done politically has been incremental. You think about Social Security and other kinds of programs that over time have grown and included more people. And in each case, every major move has required people from each side of the aisle, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberals, however you want to label them, to find compromise. There's a saying in politics that politics is the art of the possible. And that requires trade-offs and compromise and good faith. And the philosophy is that you have two different philosophies, and that people give up a little bit to meet towards the middle, and that moves us forward without drastic change. And that's worked fairly well for our country, but I'd say since the Obama years, because of the economy, the last recession where 12 million people lost their jobs, and now economists are looking back and middle-income wages have remained stagnant for 20 years. We no longer have a manufacturing sector that's robust. It's hard for people with just a high school education to get good jobs. There aren't a lot of good blue-collar jobs. We're now an economy of information, and we have a global economy. And so when Obama came in, he brought with him an agenda of multicultural change. And I think a lot of it awoke maybe some, I don't know what you want to call it, closet racism, sexism, ageism. I think the view was that government was creating more programs to help populations that had really not been upwardly mobile. And I think people in the middle of the country that saw their economy failing, their jobs dwindling, became angry. And there was a backlash. And then Obama was reelected.
Carolyn, can we come back so we can take our break?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, of course, Rick. Thank you.
All right. This question is so deep and so tangled. Let's take our break and we'll come right back with Carolyn Engelhardt. All right, back here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Always glad and thankful for WREN to make a space for us on their lineup. Carolyn Engelhardt with us, UVA School of Medicine Department, Public Health Sciences, talking with us about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. We were talking about why GOP and the Democrats are so strong about their side of the Affordable Care Act, whether it's to keep it going, whether it's to repeal and replace it. So, Carolyn, let's keep going with that.
Okay.
We're up to where we are now. It's the economic crisis, though, and the GOP is loud to highlight the fundamental weaknesses. Right? And that's what they want to talk about.
Fundamental weaknesses of the Affordable Care Act?
Right. And we'll get to where it is with the going to court. But they're still talking about, during this crisis, they're still talking about getting rid, repeal it, replace it. And strong, even though so many people have lost their jobs or had many hours cut, why?
I think there are a couple of answers. And I think that there's a philosophical belief that has run through conservative ideology forever. And that is that less government is better than more government, that the private sector can be more agile and innovative and entrepreneurial, and that by competition and free markets, people will have greater choice and more products will come forward. So I think part of it is a fear that Obamacare will turn into a single payer health system, and you could see where there'd be lots of special interest groups who would push back against that. The whole health insurance industry would go belly up. Medical device industry would be more highly regulated. Everybody would be more highly regulated, and I think at a basic level that just doesn't fit with who we are as Americans. And we're kind of in our own DNA. We are pro-individual, anti-big government. So philosophically, we're sort of predetermined to feel that way. What's happened is that once Trump became elected, he touched into this vein, this national vein of anger and resentment and feeling like whole groups of people had been forgotten and abandoned. And he really became sort of a touchstone for all of those angry sentiments having to do with the economy and so forth. And he, as I don't think your listeners will be surprised if I say this, he campaigned in 2016, and he continues the campaign on a platform of dividing the country. There are the good people and the bad people. You know, the immigrants are the bad people. Right now, the people marching in Portland, the anarchists, Antifa, they're the bad people. And he puts it in really stark terms that there are, like, the good people who will make America great again, and then they're the bad people who will drag us down and take us somewhere that's un-American. And, you know, psychology tells us that simple messages work the best. And I believe that part of the reason President Trump has been so successful in his messaging is because his message is so simple and people can just like latch onto it. He's become truly kind of a cult figure, but I think he's met his match with the pandemic because you can't say it's fake news. The virus knows no boundaries. I think even some of his supporters are now saying, you know, it's not about good versus bad. It's about something more scary. And so I think we're at a point in our political process where the Republicans want to go back to their traditional messaging of Obamacare costs too much. It's too much government. There's not enough choice for people, and it's a bad program. That's being eclipsed by the bigger public health pandemic.
Well, let's look at it from the other side, though. The Democrats continue to speak loudly and highlight the need and the good about the Affordable Care Act, but they fail to speak about how in many areas we're down to one health insurer as an option. You mentioned the cost and what had happened in Charlottesville, which is not a rarity, how some rural areas have no hospitals, and how they've closed since the Affordable Care Act. Is that something that is also a part of what's happened in the last 10 years?
Yes. The ACA is certainly not perfect at all. It has some real problems. You mentioned some of them. There's something called the subsidy cliff. So, you know, your income up to a certain point, you get a subsidy to buy health insurance. And if you're $1 over that, you get nothing. That's a problem. We now have 30 million people without health insurance, and they're made up of, pretty much three groups of people. People who are undocumented immigrants, people who are in the coverage gap, which means that they're in a state that have not expanded Medicaid, and it's a crazy thing, but they actually make too little money to go to the exchange and get a subsidy. And the third are people who are working, don't get health insurance at their jobs, have to go to the exchange to get health insurance, but they get no subsidy because they make more than 400% of the federal poverty level, and they find the products are too expensive and they can't afford them. So the ACA definitely needs some, if it's going to become the major way we pay for healthcare, and it's going to change under Biden, if Biden's elected, it's going to have to change. I mean, it's going to have to add things. And right now, I don't know if you saw in the news, but the end of June, the House of Representatives passed an Affordable Care Act, an ACA expansion, that would try to fix some of the pieces of the ACA. I'm not saying it's good or bad. Of course, it would be expensive. And of course, they're presenting it right now because they want to keep it front and center for the presidential election, because healthcare is the number one issue. It was in 2018 for the midterms, and it's very big on people's mind because so many people now have the virus, or they've lost their health insurance, and they've got loved ones in the ICU. And so healthcare is a big deal right now. So the House passed this bill. It has no chance of being passed in the Senate, and the president's already said he would veto it. But it keeps the focus. It keeps the spotlight on what Biden is saying he wants to do, which is to improve the Affordable Care Act, not ditch it and do a Medicare for all like Bernie Sanders wanted, build on what we have, try to fill the holes, and go forward. So, yes, there are problems with it. I'm not saying it's perfect. There are some conservative plans that have been floated by conservative scholars that are a different way we could configure our healthcare system, but that's not what's being talked about right now. The Republicans have no workable, they have nothing. They have not put anything out there. They have no plan if the ACA goes away. Nothing. All they have is it's terrible and we'll make it better, but there is nothing concrete out there.
So the repeal and replace is really just repeal at this point.
Right.
Has the economic downturn changed the percentage of people in support of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes. People are terrified. Right now, in many public opinion polls, even Republicans say that our healthcare system needs to cover more people, needs to be more affordable. There's a disparity between what the Democrats want and what the Republicans say they want. But even Republicans and a large group of independent voters want, no pre-existing condition exclusions. That they want security. They want safeguards. They want to know they and their loved ones won't go bankrupt if they get sick. And then I think one of the biggest challenges for Republicans going into the 2020 election, it's interesting. So I talked a little bit about the Medicaid expansion. Right now there are 14 states that have not expanded their Medicaid program, all of which have Republican governors. But the last five states that expanded Medicaid were in Republican states with Republican governors. And they were passed not by the legislature, which is the way all the other states have passed them. They were passed by ballot initiatives. So signatures from voters. And so what that has meant is that now the majority of Republican elected officials in Congress are now from states that have expanded Medicaid. And that runs in, and expanded Medicaid is part of the Affordable Care Act. It's part of Obamacare. That runs in direct opposition to I know we're going to talk about the Supreme Court case. That runs in direct opposition to the Trump administration's wanting to overturn and get rid of the ACA. And for the politicians in those states that are now representing these voters who on a ballot initiative voted to expand Medicaid, what do you do when you're an elected official? Do you toe the party line with your president, or do you try to respond the way your constituents say they want? So it's a tension there.
Carolyn Engelhardt is our guest today. She's from University of Virginia School of Medicine. We talk about the Affordable Care Act. Carolyn, we got about 3 minutes left until our next break. You mentioned the five the last five states to add ballot initiative and expand Medicaid, a form of the Affordable Care Act. Are there any other states doing anything or expected to do anything before the upcoming 2020 presidential election?
No, Oklahoma was the last one, and it will go into effect, I believe, in October. No, the states that have not expanded, I can't name them off right now, but they are the Floridas, the Texas, the North Carolina. They're the very conservative states. So I think, I mean, part of if the Democrats win in 2020, they will do things. They will try to do things to nudge those 14 states into expanding their Medicaid program. They will provide financial incentives that will make it very attractive.
I'm sitting here because we are in our own locations due to COVID-19. I'm reading this, and it says the five states allows me to do a little Google. Maine, Utah, Idaho, Nebraska, and now Oklahoma use the ballot initiative.
Right.
But Missouri voters will decide on a ballot initiative at the state's upcoming August primary.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch.
Interesting. Missouri also has a Republican governor, I believe. Again, Carolyn Engelhard, Department of Public Health Sciences, or assistant professor at UVA School of Medicine, joining us again on Sunday Morning Wake Up here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call here at 97.9 The Wren. Let's take a break, because all the questions are deep and in the weeds here when you start talking about Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, and we'll come back shortly. Hang tight, everyone. And here we are, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about topics that everyone is interested in, and we're giving it more than just the 2-minute snippet that a lot of programs give it. Because here at 60 Minutes with our guests, Carolyn Engelhard today, Affordable Care Act. Carolyn, thank you so much for being with us. And today, you know, we were just talking about which states are doing what. And we spoke earlier about the Trump administration and the effort to put a serious change on the Affordable Care Act and the Supreme Court's upcoming role. Can you tell us what's going on the Texas case?
Yes. So I have to give a little bit of background. So the day after the Affordable Care Act was passed in March of 2010, the very next day it was passed, there was a lawsuit testing its constitutionality, which eventually wound up at the Supreme Court. And 2 years later, the first ruling came down, a 5-4 decision on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, mostly having to do with the individual mandate penalty, which was if you didn't have insurance, you'd have to pay a penalty. And the Supreme Court said that a penalty was really a tax, and Congress has the power to tax, so it was constitutional. So that meant all of the ACA went forward. They did specify that the Medicaid expansion piece had to be voluntary by states, and that's why, as we were talking about before, some states have it and some states don't. So that was the first challenge. The second challenge was later, and it had to do with language within the Affordable Care Act, very specific semantics, how it was interpreted. And the Supreme Court, once again, this time 6-4, said that no, Congress met the way it was being implemented. And so those of us who have been watching it for years thought, okay, this has got to be it. Well, a funny thing happened in December 2017, after the Republicans had tried to repeal and replace Obamacare, and nothing had happened. In December 2017, they passed their what they called their tax reform bill, and that was when they reduced taxes for corporations and others. And in that bill, because you can often put in pieces in budget bills that have a fiscal impact, but may be about something else. And they said, we are going to eliminate the penalty for the Affordable Care Act under the individual mandate. So we can't, through this budget bill, this tax bill, we can't get rid of the individual mandate, but we can zero out the penalty. So there is a mandate that you all have insurance under Obamacare, but the penalty is now zero, so it's not really a mandate. And that piece of the Affordable Care Act, that individual mandate, you have to have insurance or pay a fine, a tax, was the least popular part of the legislation. So they thought they would do something for the American public that the American public wanted, and they would go back to their constituents at the end of the year with something to show, because they were a little embarrassed. They had been campaigning for years and years about getting rid of Obamacare, and here they now had the Senate and the House and the executive branch, all Republican, and they didn't do it. So they said, okay, we're going to get rid of the piece they like least. And they thought it was good. Well, they didn't realize that once they did that, they had essentially disabled the whole construct from which the original Supreme Court based their constitutionality on, which is that the individual mandate penalty is a tax. And because Congress has the ability to tax all those other pieces, like no pre-existing condition exclusions, you can't charge women more than men, there, all of those pieces came in with that. So shortly after December 2017, when the penalty, the tax, had been zeroed out, Texas, the Attorney General of Texas, and 17 other GOP attorneys general brought to district court in Texas a lawsuit saying that without the penalty, without the tax, the whole law, the whole Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional, because the piece that upheld its constitutionality in the original Supreme Court case was moot, had been removed. So they took it to a court in Texas that had a very conservative judge, and the judge ruled in the plaintiff's favor. And then it went up to the appellate level, and the appellate level in New Orleans, basically, and this is months and months and months between these things happen, had a ruling that said, we agree with the district court that the penalty, the tax, is unconstitutional. However, we're not sure the whole law is unconstitutional, and we're going to send it back to the lower court and ask the judge to review that decision, because there's a piece in all laws, there's something called severability, and it has to do with, can a law stand if one small piece of it is removed? So that's where it was. And then the Democrats, so the Trump administration, this was sort of bizarre. So remember, the defendant of this case is the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is the law of the land, but the current administration doesn't want to defend it. So normally in a case like this, the administration attorney general would defend the law of the land. But since the Trump administration wanted to get rid of Obamacare, They didn't. So 16 Democratic attorneys general, led by this guy in California, came forward to defend the ACA. And they made a plea to the Supreme Court to please take, don't wait until the district court reviews it again, but to decide, to have it come before the Supreme Court for the third time to look at the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. And the Supreme Court said that they would hear, they would take it under and have hearings, but not until their next term. And their next term starts next October. And they will entertain three legal questions. The first one is, do the plaintiffs, these conservative attorneys general from Texas and 17 other states, have standing? Do they, can they even bring the case? That's what it's called legally. Do they have standing? Can they bring this challenge? The second question is the individual mandate unconstitutional if it doesn't have a penalty? And the third question is, can the law stand without the individual mandate, which is essentially what it's doing right now, since the mandate is zero, since the penalty is zero. So those are the three questions that the court will review. It appears now, because of COVID and the Supreme Court cases having been done remotely, they didn't finish up this year. They ended their year, and they're going to come back in October and hear some cases that were left over. And so it now appears that the ACA won't come before, the constitutionality question won't come before the Supreme Court until after the election. So this gives Democrats are disappointed. They had hoped that the Supreme Court would rule on it beforehand. That's not going to happen. But what it does is it gives Democrats ammunition to go into the campaign season talking about what will happen if the ACA is overturned. And it would be tumultuous. You would have almost overnight 60 million people without insurance. You would have a whole insurance sector that would have to go back to the way it used to be, or it has, I mean, things have changed so dramatically to accommodate the Affordable Care Act. The Medicaid expansion would go away. There would be people now who, depend on lots of different kinds of services that are paid for through private insurance and government insurance that would no longer be paid for. Hospitals, uncompensated care bills would skyrocket. Some estimates are that it would increase by 80%. That means that healthcare workers would be laid off. That means that if hospitals can't make money, if you don't have people who have insurance and can pay, then hospitals will go broke. So as I mentioned in the very beginning of our show, this machine we call our healthcare system is so complex and so interconnected that all of the different stakeholders would be affected if the ACA was overturned. So that's where we are, is we're going before the Supreme Court. We're going into a campaign season. The Republicans really have put themselves in a box, because the last thing you want to do is tell people you're going to take away their insurance in the middle of a pandemic.
Carolyn Engelhardt with us today, sharing all sorts of news. I guess it's more than news. It's explanation that really drives deep about the Affordable Care Act. For those who read the headline and the first sentence or two on what's happening with the Affordable Care Act in regards to the Texas case and the Supreme Court, getting a little deeper on that topic. about 7 minutes left in our program. Carolyn, are any of these possible changes more beneficial to anyone?
Which changes?
Well, if the Texas case is the folks who are the Texas, what was the role? You said it was the Texas general
attorney,
the attorney general. If he wins, and the other attorneys general with him win the case, who else actually wins by having the Affordable Care Act stricken down?
Well, I think for those attorneys general, they believe very strongly that the ACA was passed, and that legislatively it was kind of a, you know, sleight of mirror, that it was irregular, that it from the get-go it just wasn't kosher, and that, so I think for them it's about fundamental process, but also ideology. I don't think that they were thinking about who would not have insurance and who would have insurance. For them, it was all about the legal argument based on the Constitution. So it would be a conservative legal, I guess, success in that case if you believe that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. So, and that's how they will argue it. But oftentimes, you know, the practicality, I mean, what happens on the ground, what happens in the trenches is equally important. So I guess you could say if there were some insurance companies that didn't want to be regulated as much as they are by the Affordable Care Act, that they could begin to not sell insurance to people who are sick. I mean, insurance is the one industry where they don't want anyone to use their product. So if you have shoes, if you make shoes, you want people to buy your shoes. You know, if you make widgets, you want people to buy your widgets. If you sell insurance, you don't want people to make claims because that's what makes premiums go up and you become less competitive. So if insurance companies just want to make money, you can make money by not insuring sick people. But we have over 130 million Americans that have chronic disease, and they will be sick. So Winston Churchill once said that out of crisis comes opportunity. And then Rahm Emanuel, when he was the chief of staff for Obama in the first term, said, never let a crisis go to waste. So we do have time. We have instances in our history where crises have spawned societal change for the good. Like during the Great Depression, Social Security came out of that. A lot of the federal lending program came out of that. Out of the recession of 2008 and 2009, we regulated big banks so that they couldn't have those, you know, loans that were, you know, junk essentially, and home mortgages and all of those things. So I would like to think that whichever way we go in November, if Biden gets elected, there will be a push to undo some of the things the Trump administration has done and to make the Affordable Care Act stronger and to expand it to more people who are falling through the cracks, and fill in some of the gaps and the holes. It will be expensive. It'll be a social program. It will require income redistribution. But what we all need to remember is we don't let people die in the street. We have hospitals who take care of people whether they can pay or not. And so we have to have a national conversation about what is the best way to organize the way that we pay for health care and who pays and so on. If the Trump administration wins, if Trump wins, then and the ACA may or may not be declared unconstitutional, if the Trump administration wins, it's going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure to somehow figure out how to help these millions of people who have lost their employer-sponsored health insurance because they've lost their job because of the pandemic. Maybe this is a time in our history where it's where it is finally time to talk about delinking health insurance from where you work. We are the only developed country that does that. So I'm hopeful that because we are in a crisis, we're in a public health crisis, we're in an economic crisis, we're in a crisis. Our country right now is fragile. And I am hopeful that however the 2020 election goes and whenever we are able to get a vaccine to address this virus, that it will be a wake-up call and that we will rethink how we deliver healthcare in this country and how we organize a healthcare system so that it works for most people most of the time, not just people who have good jobs, not just people who have part of labor unions, not just people who are poor and on government programs, but for all of us. And that's the challenge. And that's the challenge.
Carolyn Engelhardt, our guest today, Sunday morning wake-up call. She's from UVA's School of Medicine, Department of Public Health Services. Carolyn, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation. I'm always learning so much when you're on the show.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks to your listeners. And be safe, everybody. Be healthy. Wear your mask and hug your child or dog or loved one.
All right, let's get back to Real Oldies on 97.9 The Wren.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.